So, with that in mind, the fundamental commitment of the heart is necessary to understand all of Heidegger's influences, right? So he is really trying to get his reader because I feel like Martin Heidegger almost wrote this book for himself, because he was like, yeah, of course, I think he had greater social context and desire for that, but we know historically that the being in time we have today was only one third of what being in time was supposed to be. And so now we must actually address the controversy before we move much further. Because Heidegger's method of phenomenology and fundamental commitment of the heart is a problem for some philosophers. What do I mean by that? Martin Heidegger, the early 1930s, late 1920s, was asked to take the chair of philosophy at the University of Freiburg. However, in order to do so, he would need to take full Nazi Party membership. It is this that we cannot shy away from, because there are solid scholars that see this as a major problem for Heidegger, and actually see it as a reason for him to be annexed from the discipline, or at least read very, very carefully. So it is my obligation as the host of this show to make that known, that there is that concern of Heidegger's writing, that those ideas of the Nazi Party of the time would have influenced the way he saw things. And so I need to address that, because although I would argue, and I would argue that Heidegger's motivation to take the chair at Freiburg, as far as I know, was of noble pursuit. He saw the propaganda that was starting to sneak into the universities, and he said, I don't want that. I want the free interchange of ideas. Although that may be noble, there are people that are going to argue, and they are not unjustified, that maybe it wasn't worth it, because Heidegger took the chair at Freiburg and then a year later stepped down from the chair because he realized that he could not accomplish the goal he had set out to accomplish. So, with that in mind, that's an important note to have. And I will address this one more time near the end to hopefully give the possible Heideggerians in the audience some solace, but that's for a later time. So now that we understand that Dasein is undefined possibility that takes from experience and interprets from previous experience, and we've laid out the three fundamental rules of phenomenological investigation, we must understand also how Dasein derives this meaning. Because it's not like Dasein just is like, I'll take that, and I'll take that, and I'll take that. Dasein dwells with these things. Dasein, you know, I almost see Dasein a little bit as a small child who wanders around being enraptured by the things that it sees. Right, like a kid in a candy shop for the first time, and it's like, wow, sees all the lollipops, and wants to grab all of it. Heidegger says, or Heidegger, I think, uses that moment of where Dasein can get so enraptured. He calls this ensnarement, that Dasein can get so focused on an experience an experience, and deriving meaning from that experience, that it actually loses focus on what its fundamental commitment is. And Dasein, man, there's so much to Heidegger as I'm talking aloud and trying to condense this all down for you guys. So let me do a quick summation, and then maybe my colleagues can help direct me on where they want to hear me go next. So you have being, which is undefined possibility, which is then channeled through a fundamental commitment of your heart. And as you investigate your being and investigate experience, you go to the experience itself and try to sit, dwell, and enter into the world of which that is happening. And then you have the realization that even though two people can have the exact same experience, they may view that entirely differently. The fundamental commitment of the heart is entirely necessary. It's also important to realize that Heidegger's concept of being in the world is such that Dasein reaches out and waits for a response. And from that response comes into relation with that experience. And so Heidegger would say, your childhood, for example, you can remember your childhood. You can recall experiences, but Heidegger would label that time frame an epochal world. What does that mean? It means it's a world in which you can see, you can recall, but you cannot interact with directly. You're not gonna get new response from that. You can't go back there and physically just dwell and be present with that. You're always gonna be the whatever you are, currently the 22-year-old version of me who can look back and see how my childhood has shaped me. And so it's this idea of dwelling. That dwelling is Dasein entering into relation with an experience or with itself. And in a sense, I feel like Martin Buber is a good parallel to this a little bit. That Martin Buber talks about I-thou relationships, the I as the individual and the thou as the thing that can be experienced but not known. That is Dasein's relation to the unknown. Dasein knows itself, but how Dasein knows itself is in relation to its own mortality. Heidegger would say that Dasein is the only thing of which its very existence is a problem for it. Now that you understand being, to also understand that it's influenced by its own mortality. As many other existentialist thinkers focus on, right? The reality of one's mortality as a driving factor to live a moral life or a virtuous life or a meaningful life, it is not lost on people like Nietzsche. In fact, I think Nietzsche would say the pressure's on because you no longer have God to repent to for when you failed to do so. The pressure's on. And Sartre would take that a step further to say, the decisions I make are decisions for all humanity. Right? There's a sense of obligation and imperative to act. And for Heidegger, he He understands being to be that thing that desires to derive meaning because it realizes one day it will cease to exist. And that is particularly why he is so critical of Dasein's tendency, because of its origination in the they, right, in the doing things over and over and over again, because that's what it's always done, to get ensnared, because he says you're missing the point of life.
I wanted to maybe guide you towards one other thing that might be interesting to talk about, which is this idea about transcending facts or facticity. I don't know if you've, you know, how much you've encountered this idea, but basically, to take a summary from that I'm reading from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, it basically talks about the fact that we as humans have the capability to basically transcend the facts of the world that we're living in and relate to and interpret and make sense of things in a way that's separate from, you know, the facts of the world. So, for example, I'm quoting here. Yeah, so facts about our, there are determined aspects or facts about our situation that limit and constrain us. This is our givenness or facticity, and it includes aspects of our being such as our embodiment and spatiality, our creaturely appetites and desires, and the socio-historical context we find ourselves in. But what distinguishes us as humans is that we have the capacity to rise above or transcend these facts in the way we relate to, interpret, and make sense of them. If I'm compelled by a strong desire for sex, alcohol, or cigarettes, for instance, I do not out of necessity have to act on these desires. I have the freedom to question them and give them meaning, and the meanings I attribute to them shape my choices and the direction my life will take going forward. I think that's another interesting thing, because Heidegger, much like all the other existentialists, is clearly giving us an idea of really being responsible for our own lives and the way in which we live our own lives and the way we interact with the world. So while it might not make a lot of sense to members of the audience that, you know, to think about the world in the way Heidegger suggests we should, I was wondering if maybe you want to touch on just that aspect of transcending the realities of our situation and acting on free will, essentially, and the question of free will as it relates to Heidegger, because I think that's always something philosophers argue about or struggle with, is free will. So I thought it'd be interesting.
Yeah. Heidegger is a big fan of free will, because if Dasein isn't free, Dasein ceases to exist. Because Dasein can either choose possibility, it can create it, or it can stumble upon it. I would say more often we go through life, and this is Heidegger's critique, we kind of stumble through, you know, just kind of doing what we do, and then all of a sudden we're given an opportunity, we take that, we wake up for 5 minutes, and then we fall back asleep again. So I think Heidegger would be a big fan, because to have the freedom to choose is essential to Heidegger's very ideas. So for Heidegger to be deterministic, he would say the they in which you were born into was determined. But how you step out of that and come to terms with your own mortality, that's a choice that you have to make. So he would have to naturally be a free will fan for that to happen. I think the idea of transcending our circumstances is exactly where the epochal world comes into, right? Having that perspective that, okay, your childhood is no longer the world you're in, but it has still affected you. And so having this understanding that although something may still affect you, does not necessarily mean it has to be an all-encompassing determining factor, I think is key to Dasein as well, because that's Dasein's Dasein's creation and choice, right? Is Dasein can choose to go back to childhood and become ensnared in those memories and experiences, or it can interpret that experience and say, well, those experiences are the very things that have brought us to this moment. And then to say, okay, now that we're here, what choices do we make going forward so that maybe we repeat some of the same behaviors because those were good behaviors, or maybe we have to leave behind some of the ideas that we used to have. So I think when it comes to the idea of transcendence, especially because Dasein is possibility, being isn't this corporeal thing that is enslaved to the body necessarily, I think there is a great potential. And you see this in later Heideggerian literature when you read something like the pathway. Heideggerian scholars will talk about the turn in Heidegger's work. The turn being this kind of moment where Heidegger kind of comes up against this brick wall and he can't continue in this kind of angsty vibes he's created. And so he goes far more into this romantic, poetic imagery and writes something like The Origin of the Work of Art, right? And understanding that as we look at an artwork, we're not simply looking at an artwork, but we're actually entering into relation with that artwork. And I mean, I'm happy to do a show on the origin of the work of art one day, but it's Heidegger is very much relational, and so I think that also speaks to free will, that there's this question of non-free will, and is that truly relational? Is that truly free relation, or is that more the Nietzschean idea of master and slave morality, where one person sees it as forced or not. Brandon, any questions? Mihai, any questions? That was a bit of a long ramble.
There's something to me about Heidegger being inherently very difficult to grasp or to understand that bugs me. And the reason for that is, how would you say that people in the audience, for example, that are interested in these ideas should go about incorporating them into their own lives? Something as difficult to grasp as Dasein, for example, as that this reconsideration of yourself as a completely different kind of unit relative to the world, not a unit relative to the world, as a matter of fact, like these ideas. What would you say is the value, or has the value been to you, of Heidegger's writing and Heidegger's ideas, despite the way in which they're formulated and the kind of demands they make about the way you see the world? Because I'm curious, you also mentioned your thesis and your ideas of identity and that kind of thing, and I'd be curious to know maybe how that all comes into it at the end of the day.
It's the existential realization that you have to step out eventually. You can't just go down the river. Eventually you have to resist a little bit and start to carve your own way, right? You have to be snapped to attention and really ask yourself the questions. And I guess how I would apply it is I would say ask yourself the three fundamental principles of phenomenology in question form, to say, who am I? How do I see myself? Those may seem like the same question, but they're radically different, because who am I is a more general question. How do I see myself is more specific. And then to say, what is the fundamental commitment of my heart? What is something I am working towards, or I want to work towards? And then use that as a springboard to actually channel your focus into that. So in relation to my thesis project, the existential exploration of identity and disability, you you Heidegger is central to me deconstructing who I am as a disabled person, and says, no, I am Tegan, hear me roar. But also it's one of those things where it's like, yes, I am me, but how does my disability actually channel my being and my decisions? How does that influence the possibilities that I have in front of me already, that I will create and that I am working towards accomplishing? So although Heidegger is very difficult to grasp at points, I would say he gives you a couple good questions. He gives you, what does it mean to be you? And I know that seems like a big question. Honestly, do kind of what I had to do in my thesis project and kind of lay out a day. What is it like to be you day to day? And understand what you're doing day after day after day, and say, the things that are optional, is that something that I really want to continue doing? And that is a conversation that fundamentally comes when you understand what you're working towards. Because maybe you started that habit when you were working towards something. Maybe you're no longer working towards that goal. And so maybe writing that down and realizing that, you're able to say, well, don't need to do that anymore. Or maybe I need to do more of that. I don't know. But right, to understand the world in which you come from, where you are today, and then ultimately where you are going. Heidegger is a great way to start to set out a set of goals for your life. Because he gives you that idea of understanding that, okay, you can't escape where you came from, but you can start to step out and make changes going forward. And then ultimately, right, what is the fundamental commitment of your heart? What are you working towards? I think for me, that was Heidegger's biggest grasp, was Dasein is possibility. How do I want to channel this possibility? How have I channeled it? And how has the experiences that I've had influenced that? And of course, if you ever stumble across my thesis project, which you just might, the goal is publication. The whole thing of death is a real thing. And so how do you make your life matter? What does it mean to leave a legacy? I did a show on that a number of years back. Maybe I should revisit that topic. What does it mean to leave a legacy? I think that was probably Heidegger's biggest question. And it's a question he doesn't explicitly state, but I think that's why he tried to put so much effort and energy into being in time. So, right. Was, how will I be remembered? And so before I kind of do my wrap-up spiel, any questions, comments from our colleagues?
I was going to say, too, about the kind of difficulty of Heidegger. I like to think of reading Heidegger as kind of being in an airplane that is experiencing turbulence. It's a very distressing experience. Like, you kind of have to strain yourself to keep yourself still and stop from getting up and running away. I think it has to do with his project of shaking things up, of wanting to revitalize the ideas that he's talking about. I think it also goes hand in hand with why he feels like he has to invent so many new terms, coin all these neologisms, because he's talking about the same things, or he's talking about very familiar things. He's going through processes of arriving at those things in a fresh way and then saying, look, we came up with this thing. It's called the uncanny. Well, that's been talked about. But we don't know that that's kind of what's been talked about, because it's just background noise at this point. It's just a part of metaphysics. we don't really know that it's there. We don't experience it. It doesn't have a phenomenology. We don't bump up against it because we just kind of understand the conceptual structures that lead to it. So I think that the reason Heidegger is doing what he does is the same reason that he kind of, we might today say, blew up. The question of what was Heidegger's reception before he published Being in Time, which was his first publication. He was already famous with the students passing around notes. He was known as the Magician of Messkirk. And then Husserl comes to him one day and is like, you've got to publish something. And he's like, I don't have anything published, or I don't have anything ready. He's like, get something. And then he just fires off Being in Time super quick.
The way I see Heidegger is a very energetic man saying to the students of the philosophy today, how much do you want it? Because if you want it, you will seek to understand it. And I think that was very much true to his experience. If you want the fundamental commitment of your heart to come to pass, you will investigate and make that happen. In the last 60 seconds, I said I would give the future Heideggerian scholars hope and maybe some renewed enthusiasm with Heidegger's controversy. It's been reported, not confirmed, but it's been reported by scholars attributed to his student, Anna Arendt, that Heidegger later on in life said to her at his 80th birthday party that he regretted taking the position at Freiburg because he realized how that had damaged his reception in the academic space after that point. But I think he still has great value and great importance in existentialism and also in the discipline at large. And with that, this has been the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host, Tegan Marshall, here with me, Heikel Vosser and Brandon Brownlee. We'll talk to you next time. Bye for now.
You can find archived recordings of the Canadian Philosophy Show on mixcloud.com/thecanadianphilosophyshow and tcps.podbean.com.